Okay, so Natasha asked me to talk about dealing with grid codes, and since I've been coping emotionally with grid codes for the better part of my life, I guess that means something different to me. But so it's going to be a pretty technical talk. So you know, hopefully by the end I'll have all of you asleep because the experts will have seen the stuff before and the non-experts. But it's you know, it's all stuff that you should pay attention to if you use or interpret simulations. Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about some varieties of error in simulations and their origin, and then deal with some issues with initial conditions for focusing on common envelope simulations, but generally associated with. With any 3D global simulations of stars. And I figured that boundary conditions are important, but I just didn't think I would have time to touch on them. They're in there for completeness, but not to cover. And then specifically, one of the things that Natasha mentioned was conservation. And so I'll talk about that and show some tests that I've done that sort of illustrate why worry. Anyway, and then finally give you hopefully some guidance. Actually, Stephen said I should provide wisdom, which made me quake in my boots because I'm not sure I have much to offer. But okay, so we'll talk about errors first, and so I like to start with the beginning. So Lewis Fry Richardson, I don't know. You could think of him as the father of modern weather forecasting, and he also contributed a lot of interesting ideas. I mean, he's the origin of the eddy cascade picture of turbulence, as far as I understand. Yeah, so you know, he had a nice little limerick sort of illustrating that. But one of the things he did was, in the early part of the 20th century, he came up with the idea of solving the Navier-Stokes equations, actually, using initial conditions from a bunch of weather stations covering Central Europe. And as you can see, he's got a very, very coarse grid. It's a staggered mesh. So he stores scalar quantities on a mesh that's staggered with respect to vector quantities. And then try to predict the weather in a few days. And of course, you do very, very badly with this because it's a chaotic system. And this resolution is far too coarse to capture the initial conditions of any particular day. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in these little cells that greatly influences the solution later times, in a few days even. So this is, you know, kind of a failure. But you know, presaged the future. And indeed, he presaged the future in another way. And that is, he realized, of course, this was in the era of hand computation or maybe mechanical computation, but very, very slow. And he envisioned this sort of computational theater where you'd have sort of the map of the world projected onto this dome. And then these balconies with all these numerous people, human computers, each taking a little piece of the grid, and you know, doing a finite difference to get to the next step using information from their neighbors, and here down in the middle is a pedestal with a control person who shines a green light on parts of the calculation that are, you know, going too fast, need to slow down, and. Or the other way around, going too slowly you need to speed up, and red light on the ones going too fast. So it keeps things synchronized. So a parallel human computer. Obviously, you know, he would have been punished severely if he tried to actually make this. But you know, it's an interesting idea and a sort of.
Isn't that, you know, it's not so different than what the Los Alamos did in the war and NASA did in the early.
Yeah, maybe not.
No punishment, but probably got fired. So,
well,
we still have human computers in the 1960s in my country.
Wow.
We had fired.
Isn't that what all the movie was about?
That's right.
Figures. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And so they were punished, actually.
That's Yeah, but I mean, just, you know, the sort of the torture, I guess, maybe working as an individual serial human computer.
And probably also wanted punished forward pretty too punished. Fast. Being,
yeah, but see, but, you know, being forced to work in lockstep with a large number of people in this huge theater would probably, I don't know, drive any normal person insane, I think. Anyway, so that's where we began. And sort of a fundamental question you have to ask when you set about trying to solve differential equations numerically is how you're going to represent the solution. And there are many different ways. I'm just going to cover a couple of the major categories, finite differencing and finite volume. So finite differencing is where you have a mesh, and here I'm just going to focus on structured meshes. Finite differencing is where you're actually representing the values of the solution at different points in space. And you can also have, as Richardson did, a staggered mesh where, you know, some quantities are represented at some locations and others at other locations, maybe staggered by half a zone. In finite volume, what you're manipulating are actually zone averages of the solution. And so these seem pretty similar, but they actually have subtly different properties, especially at higher order, that that are important for what we'll talk about.
Wait, do I get to complain, or should I wait? The finite volume is great, but I'm going ahead anyway. You can say no. Finite volume is great, but it doesn't that oversimplify a little bit? I mean, they still are keeping some values at self boundaries similar to the.
You're not tracking them generally, no.
Okay, you don't track a separate velocity of a cell boundary, you recompute it.
It's reconstructed,
yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, the things that are the constraints, the degrees of freedom in the problem, are the cell averages in finite volume.
Okay.
So what do we do with these stored values, right? Well, in finite differencing, you know, we use Taylor expansions. So right there, you can, you know, say there's a problem because, you know, Taylor expansions work for sufficiently smooth functions, you know, within a neighborhood around a point. And whenever we have something that's high Mach number, you know, we already have discontinuities in that problem. So this is already gonna show you that there's some issues with this, but they're generally tractable. Anyway, so the Taylor expansion about each point, then we evaluate it at each of a point and its neighbors. And then we form linear combinations of those where we truncate the expansion in some order and use those to construct different representations of the derivative at point I, for example, in terms of its neighbor quantity value, neighbor values. So here's a first order, second order, fourth order difference. And you can have one-sided differences, you can have centered differences. And this error that comes about because you truncate the Taylor expansion is naturally called truncation error. And it generally swamps in an individual time step. It swamps round-off error and any other little sources of error. It's the dominant source of error in a single step. But as you take many, many time steps, then round-off error can be an issue. So I'm not going to really touch on round-off error that much, but just to differentiate the two.
Truncation error is canceled over many steps. Is that what you're saying?
They can partially cancel, yeah.
They all be the same size.
The thing is that except for fairly simple differencing schemes, there usually is no, you know, nice, you know, way. I mean, you could actually compute this. For a simple difference like this, I could just carry this out to another order and see what the error is. But oftentimes you don't have a nice expression for that. And in finite volume, as I said, the constraints are now zone averages, and so then you substitute a Taylor expansion in here and you do this, you know, do this integral, and you get a different expression for the zone averages at neighboring cells, and as a result, you know, the resulting difference expressions are different. But generally only above second order. So the first and second order difference expressions are the same. And as you go to higher order, you see you get different coefficients here, right? Minus 1, 8, minus 8, plus 1, and then minus 5 is 34, minus 34, plus 5. So these do differ in important ways here. And, you know, it's not just a trivial distinction. You know, I'll come back to finite volume later when I talk about conservation, because that's the primary reason for going to that slightly extra effort.
Can I ask, you could go to higher order if someone is probably not paying off because you have too many expressions to evaluate, but...
There are various trade-offs. So so there are some numerical methods that do actually very high order, like 16th order, to capture smooth flow very accurately. So essentially non-oscillatory methods, for example. And you do that because you need very, very high accuracy. You need to reduce the truncation error a lot. But you suffer in the sense that at the edge of a grid, you're always referring to as many neighbors as you have points in your stencil on either side. And so at the boundaries of your grid, you need to construct boundary information that's that many zones deep. So like if I have a first order difference, I only need one layer of boundary zones. But if I have a 16th order difference, you know, I need 8 layers of boundary zones.
Would you take your first order at the boundary, second order at the next step, and then increase, or is that not?
That's going to generally contaminate.
Because then your scheme is only as good as the lowest order. So, really?
Well, in a hyperbolic system, right?
Basically, there's some matrix which you have to build and the size of the land or the boundaries.
Okay. You guys made two partially correct statements. That's true for implicit schemes. And that's true immediately for elliptic solvers. But for a hyperbolic problem, right, it depends on how far characteristics have been able to propagate in a given amount of time. So eventually, yes. Characteristics from the low-order boundaries will propagate in and contaminate your solution at first order or whatever it was you were doing.
But wouldn't it be just taken care by Seidel condition? I mean, you just take that to your time step.
Just limits the time step, right? I mean, your characteristics still propagate, right? It's just how many time steps does that take to happen? Right. Instead of taking one big jump, you take a lot of small jumps, but eventually it gets there.
Seidel's necessary but not sufficient.
Okay, so I want to illustrate a couple, and so all this pretty basic stuff. So I want to illustrate a couple of basic points about the character of truncation error by looking at probably the prototype hyperbolic equation, which is the linear advection equation. It's just the continuity equation with a constant speed, so that it looks just, it's a wave equation, right? And so there are classic finite difference schemes dating back to Manhattan Project and the years afterward, and motivated in part by things like, you know, trying to solve highly compressible flows that, you know, you get from explosions. And one of them is the first order upwind scheme, and second is a second order lax windrow scheme. And so this uses a one-sided difference. It's upwinded, so it gets information from the side that in the problem information is flowing from. And in the case of the lax windrow scheme, it's a combination of this thing called forward time-centered space, which is numerically unstable, and so I'm not going to focus on it here. But it then adds by using this to replace a time derivative with a space derivative, actually adds a second derivative term, which acts like a diffusive effect here. So that stabilizes forward time-centered space and increases, keeps the order the same. So yeah, so the Courant-Friedrichs-Lewy criterion, I don't know if it's Lewy or Levy, I've never wondered, but CFL criterion is a limit for all these explicit schemes where, if you have an expression that's the updated value of a quantity and then something that includes just values at the previous time step and earlier, there's always a stability constraint, which if you violate, if you try to take a step that's too big, the thing will rapidly develop exponentially growing solutions and choke. So this is why we can't just say start at the beginning and then jump immediately to the end of a problem and say this is the final result. That would be nice. And the implicit schemes that Natasha implicitly referenced allow you, they give you unconditional stability, but at the price of accuracy. So you can take a giant time step, but then you lose all correctness in the solution if you take a time step that's too big. So these are, like most methods in use are, you know, for dynamical timescale stuff, would be explicit schemes.
Why did you write that A is positive?
Oh, just to simplify things. I mean, if A is negative and you do this, then this is unstable. It becomes a downwind scheme. So if A is negative, then you'd have to, you know, you have the difference from the positive from I plus one to I instead of the other way. Yeah, I don't want to go too much into numerical stability and stuff, but you know, you teach a whole semester class, and actually I do,
in this CFL condition, there delta x should be the smallest mesh point that you have.
That's an interesting point. So this is locally, right, stable. So the local value of delta x. So if you had a mesh that was, you know, that had varying mesh spacing, for example, and you took a time step that was stable for, let's say, the largest zones, but not stable for the smallest zones, and the place you would see instability starting to develop would be in the smallest zones first.
And then, yeah, and then it breaks out.
That it would eventually break down.
And if A varies, you apply it cell by cell.
Yeah.
That's right. So generally, you'd say find the minimum time step across the whole grid, and then take that.
You can break up delta T into different zones, but it's not always worth it.
Right. Right. Yeah. There are far more complicated schemes where you can actually. And certainly, like adaptive mesh refinement, you can also have different time steps on the different grids. And by doing time interpolation, you can match them up. Anyway, again, a whole semester. So,
something that may someday wants to do before it's more time steps than Bill Gondor.
Yeah, and I think MESA, I mean, effectively does implicit differencing. Right?
Yes. Or, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It can do explicit as well.
Okay. So anyway, so let's look at these two schemes. And one of the simple test problems you can do with linear advection is to take a square wave, right? And what does linear advection do? It just moves stuff at speed A. Right? So the square wave should stay a square wave and just be translated. Well, upwind doesn't quite do that. Right? So here I've chosen a stable time step. And I'm just, you know, advecting for 100 steps. And you see it starts off square, but then it starts to get rounded at the edges. And it gets rounding, roundedness gets worse and worse. It does seem to preserve the amplitude here, fortunately, at the center, but eventually they'll get whittled away too. And this will just, anyway, as time goes to infinity, this will just blur out into a mess. Right. So why did this happen? Right. You're solving a wave equation that should just move stuff around. Well, if you replace, you go back and you replace each of the quantities in the update with a Taylor expansion and plug those back into the update, you can come up with something called a modified equation, which is the equation you're really solving. Right? You think you're solving the advection equation, but you're not. You're solving a different equation. The equation you're solving looks like what you wanted, but then the leading error term, which comes from truncation error, looks like this, 1 half a delta x times the second derivative of q, which is a diffusion term, with diffusion coefficient 1 half a delta x. Right? So that's telling you right away that, you know, this should be something that moves along, you know, as an advection diffusion equation. It moves along at speed a, but then, you know, it gradually gets smeared out where there are sharp jumps. So, in general, first-order schemes all have a diffusive truncation error like this. Now, if you look at the way Lax-Wendroff behaves on this problem, yeah. Now, it's not unstable. It's not unstable. You know, I chose a time step that was stable, but you see that it's developing this Gibbs phenomenon at the at these jumps, and that Gibbs phenomenon doesn't go away. In fact, it eventually contaminates everything up, downstream, right? Everything that stuff has passed through gets contaminated with this. And so what's happening here is that in Lax-Wendroff, the truncation error, the modified equation, the leading order truncation error term is now the same, you know, it's like the same order as the time derivative. So
And you had to take 8 or 9 times as many time steps while evaluating more terms in order to do this, right?
No, it's the same number of steps here to get to this point.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean,
is 100 or is 100 steps or 100 delta, yeah?
100 steps.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not worried right now about the actual time it makes to get to. Just how does this, how does things change after a fixed number of steps? And so, so instead of a d squared q dx squared, I have a d cubed q dx cubed, which isn't quite a wave equation, but it behaves kind of like a wave equation. It produces a dispersive error so that you get oscillation, right? And so this is the generic feature of higher order methods, second order methods. And in general, numerical schemes will have some combination of this diffusive low order error and dispersive high order error, where, and you can see even in Lax Wendroff, right, there's some damping of the dispersive error. I'm not sure if that's due to the actually included diffusion term or if that's because of the fourth order error. Because you always have truncation error has a leading order term, but it also has all the rest as well. So those are the two kinds of error that that you worry about. And so there were a lot of schemes, for instance, in the 70s, where people were trying to combine different ways, combine low order and high order methods in judicious ways to make it so that in smooth flow, you know, you got the high order and high accuracy, but in places where you got a jump like that, you tolerated a little bit of diffusion to avoid getting this sort of behavior. Things like flux-corrected transport. And, yeah.
Is this in part due to the fact that you started with a square wave and you have a strange step function that it would be somewhat smoother, would it take longer to develop?
Well, that's the whole idea. Like if I start with it, yeah, so you can pick test problems that look good for any particular numerical method. Right, and this is one that looks bad for both of these methods.
In fact, Gaussian looks fine.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Although I think the amplitude may, well, certainly in the upwind case.
Eventually,
yeah.
You get it way there too.
Yeah.
So nature doesn't have too many step functions, so maybe.
Well, that's a shocking thing to say.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, and actually, this gets into the next slide. So, so one of the ways you can deal with these step functions, right, is to do what. Von Neumann and Rickmeyer. Actually, Rickmeyer, I think, started this in 1948 from when I was reading. But to add an artificial viscosity that smears out shocks deliberately. And the idea here is that, you know, you could maybe avoid some of these higher order errors by, you know, by removing the discontinuities. And as long as you tuned this appropriately, you would get the correct shock speed and the correct shock jump, because all that diffusion does is there sort of delays, you know, delays the compression. And but as we'll see, it turns out that the amount of this viscosity is, you know, has to be tuned exactly to give the right behavior and for any given numerical method. So it's not good for that, and it's also bad because, you know, it kills your resolution. I mean, you're paying for every one of those zones. Right, so you would like to get as much squeeze as much resolution out as possible, and if you're smearing out all your features so that you can resolve them, then you know, you may be, you know, you may actually wind up doing a lot more work just by having to go to a much finer grid than you would if you could figure out a smarter scheme to propagate these discontinuities.
I thought that von Neumann and Rickmeyer of quadratic viscosity always spread it over like 3 or 4 zones. You know, it didn't have to be tuned for any particular. You've got a very strong shock, it's still getting.
I think for the numerical method, it has to be tuned. Like if you know, you can add this in to any numerical method. But I think that the psi that you need for any given case.
But once you pick that psi, you don't have to do it for every single problem. You know?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think. All right. So it's important to distinguish, though, this artificial viscosity, which is added. You know, to damp these dispersive errors, or you could think of even Lax-Wendroff as involving a kind of artificial viscosity to stabilize forward time-centered space. You've got to distinguish that from numerical viscosity, which is something that you have whether you like it or not. just because you've discretized partial differential equations. That is unavoidable where this is, you know, something you choose to do. And I guess Jamie will probably talk about that in the context of SPH, because normally, well, anyway, I'll let him do that. But so artificial viscosity is optional, well, quasi-optional, and then this is not optional. Now, now with my scalar advection equation.
So the nice thing with the, you know, the problem with the top one is you can't control it. The bottom one, you have it in, you can vary it and see how it affects your results. So on my thing of what are your errors, it's really good if you have an artificial viscosity to vary it to see what is it doing your results.
Yeah, that's one way.
Can I just ask, you said that the artificial viscosity is going to get you to the correct jump conditions in the end, no matter what. But if you have waves being emitted into the push-off region, that's not necessarily true, because now the energy balance doesn't work out.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just thinking in terms of like a single wave that's just propagating, like we've seen here. Yeah, but you're right. Yeah, interactions between waves in particular will lead to very different results if you're smoothing. So the real Euler equations, of course, are not linear advection. In fact, you know, we have, for instance, it's advection of the velocity, but with the velocity itself as the speed. And so it's a nonlinear advection equation. And so that means that the diffusive truncation error right here is going to be proportional to d squared v dx squared, which means that in places, for example, like where the velocity is close to zero, that may vanish. And if that truncation error, that diffusive truncation error, is stabilizing the method that you're using, then it's vanishing it locally may cause the method to become unstable at that point. So you can generate noise at places where the velocity vanishes, or whether it's a sonic point, for example. And then because the whole problem isn't unstable, because you have this diffusion elsewhere, you know, those errors that are generated there try to propagate out and they get damped. But you can get artifacts that result from that fact, just from the behavior of truncation error with velocity. And so all these classic schemes are nice because they're simple and they're easy to analyze. But of course, modern schemes that do things like solve Riemann problems generally are a lot more complicated to analyze, and it's hard to actually figure out the, you know, like a simple expression for the truncation error. So generally, we sort of go with heuristic arguments and just looking at the results on test problems to see what the truncation, how it behaves in a modern method. So these are both numerical in origin, and then there's the physical viscosity, which, you know, in a Navier-Stokes equation, the kinematic viscosity should have an amplitude of something like the mean free path times the sound speed. And if your velocities are comparable to the sound speed, if you have compressible flow, then the truncation error diffusion coefficient is going to be something like V times the zone spacing. So if you're doing a fluid problem, right, the mean free path has to be a lot smaller than delta X, right? So this is going to be generally a lot smaller than the truncation error. So except for certain types of problems where this might be large enough to care about, is generally swamped by the numerical effects. Which is why, for instance, if you're doing an Navier-Stokes solution where you really care about viscous effects, you might want high order to beat that down as much as possible. Okay, and I'm not going to talk a lot about this because I'm not up on the details of it, but I wanted to just highlight that most of the time we're doing what's called implicit large eddy simulation, which is where we're trying to directly solve the integral scale of turbulence, but we're not actually putting in an explicit expression for the viscosity. And so we kind of hope that a cascade, you know, if it's turbulent flow, that a cascade develops that looks something like the real thing. And you know, there's been some effort to compare like the behavior of the PPM scheme, piecewise parabolic method scheme, with Navier-Stokes solutions with diminishing viscosity, and showing that, you know, it does reproduce roughly the kind of energy spectrum that you expect from that. But anything that involves, for instance, backscatter from unresolved scales, if you're not putting in viscosity and you're not putting in some kind of explicit subgrid turbulence model, then you're probably getting that wrong. And so that's particularly important in MHD turbulence simulations, but also somewhat in hydro.
But typically the numerical viscosity is higher than any viscosity you might put in, right? For most astrophysical problems, so there's not really...
Yeah, there's no choice. I'm not...
I'm putting it in and now I'm good because you're putting in something way smaller than what your numerics is. You're still not good.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So that's why you kill the small scale turbulence. So why you overproduce intermediate scale turbulence?
Oh, right here?
Yeah.
That's backscatter.
I don't know the word.
Could you also think of it as a sort of a bottleneck problem where you have this energy trying to cascade?
Yeah, it might not be stuff coming from small scales. It might just be energy isn't transferring from large scales to small scales without some impediment, right? Something where energy is piling up here. And
how much does that vary? Because this is PPM with explicit viscosity or without?
Without,
right. So then it depends on the grid size, right?
Yeah.
So how does that, vary?
Again, I didn't want to go too much into it because I don't know all the details, but
I think it looks the same. It's just that scale depends on how fine it is.
Yeah, so they did vary. I think this is like 1024 cubed here. But,
right, but if what I'm saying is that will move over presumably, right? Yeah, for smaller.
It just has the same feature. It just moves around.
So you, this might be a bit too detailed, as you were mentioning, but so here you're just calculating the kinetic energy spectrum. You have k to the minus 5/3 Kolmogorov prediction, and we know that the Kolmogorov theory only makes the correct prediction for this specific statistic. Mm-hmm. So how about some of the other statistics? How does PPM can?
I don't know. Okay. Yes, that's I wanted to, you know, not say anything about this because it's important. But also, I don't know what the current status.
Follow-up question would be: what would the spectral code of the same resolution look like on this problem?
Yeah, so the NS, that's probably a spectral code.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's not. No. It's PPM with explicit viscosity.
PPM with explicit viscosity.
Yeah, in this case.
Yeah.
All right, yeah, but I mean, if you're well-resolved, it doesn't matter if you're using PPM or spectral. You look at the same answer, right? If you're well-resolved, you have the right answer. So it doesn't matter what method you're using.
I'm not sure that...
As long as they're both consistent representation, but yes. Yeah.
As long as one code isn't doing something wrong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's, if they don't agree, then it's a bug. So one thing I did want to highlight, though, is that that with problems that involve turbulence or that involve instabilities that can generate turbulence, resolution is and convergence are not straightforward, actually. So this is from a paper Alan Calder did. On the validation of the flash code, and particularly with the Rayleigh-Taylor instability. And so this is, just taking a single mode Rayleigh-Taylor instability and resolving it progressively. And as you see, there seems to be a sort of monotonic behavior as you go to higher resolution, that the spike length is getting longer, but it's, it seems to be converging to something. And then you resolve a scale, suddenly I guess the numerical Reynolds number goes over some threshold and it becomes turbulent. And now, we retreat from the solution that we seem to be converging toward. Yeah, I would say no, yeah.
All right, but this is just because they don't have any explicit dissipation. If they put in dissipation, then as they increase resolution, it would converge. And then they could do that for different dissipation rates and see what happens as that dissipation goes to zero. And in fact, the result of that might be different than the result of doing the inviscid simulation, as they've done here, just solving Euler equation in the limit of resolution going to infinity.
Yeah.
Well,
I think that's known, right? That if you solve Navier-Stokes they're highly resolved, that it actually is a different solution than boiler.
It can be.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think that this is kind of, you know, if you'd looked at this with different resolutions, it would be addressing that question. And I think the answer is, like
so
Chris was saying, that this.
So solvent-malleus docks with zero viscosity will give a different solution from Euler, which is actually a form of malleus docks with zero viscosity.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's right.
In the limit
of zero viscosity is not the same as boiler.
Superfluids are not the same as the limit of zero viscosity.
Right.
So, but I mean, I think that.
It's the case.
Well, so one thing I worried about with this talk is that I might leave you with the impression that we can't do anything.
Which is not true. We also know that. We don't know it. We're still doing it, so you know.
Yeah, that's not quite right. But I mean, but you know, clearly you have to be very careful with convergence. Like, suppose that you know this were a paper where we were saying, okay, you know, Rayleigh-Taylor instability is generated in our simulation, and we doubled the resolution, and yeah, things look pretty similar. We're converged. Well, if we could have afforded to go, you know, 8 times higher resolution, maybe we would have seen something somewhat different.
So it's better than not doing the exercise, but you have to keep in mind that you could cross a threshold.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess is, you know, doing a simulation is no substitute for analysis, for understanding the problem and what the important length scales are. So this is all with, well, actually, this is a uniform grid, right? So this is all uniform grid. You see how complicated things can be with a uniform grid. So, but, you know, I think, oh, Bill was telling Maggie something about how humans like challenges. So, of course, the problem with uniform grids is that, you know, we get thin structures in astrophysics, and so a uniform grid that could capture them while capturing the box sizes that we needed would be prohibitively expensive in many cases. And so we need ways of trying to focus our computational effort in places where it's really needed. And so, you know, adaptive mesh refinement was born for this purpose. And, you know, just again, this is sort of like a detailed field with many different iterations or versions of AMR. But so two categories of AMR. One is sort of patch-based AMR, the classic Berger and Olliger scheme, where you have mesh patches that may overlap. They may even be rotated. I've never seen that. They have different numbers of zones. And you do things, you interpolate from a coarse mesh to a fine mesh to set up initial conditions and then propagate things, and then you interpolate boundary conditions between the two meshes. And there are a lot of details that go into how you do those interpolations and things you have to worry about. But that's the basic idea. And the nice thing about this patch-based AMR is that it's relatively flexible. So if you've got complicated structures like this, well, this is not very complicated, I guess. But as you can see, you can have patches that you know very closely match that. The problem, of course, is that computationally, you know, with cache-based computers, actually even with vector machines, I guess, you know, computers are most efficient when dealing with chunks of data that are the same size all the time. And this is clearly providing you with a case where everything's adaptive and everything's a different chunk size. So an alternative is octree AMR, octree because in three dimensions you make a tree that where each parent block has 8 children. And each mesh block now has the same number of zones. It's a factor of 2 refinement per level. So the refinement pattern is a little bit less flexible. You have to go to a higher number of levels of refinement to get, you know, quite the same behavior here. But you can also represent things you know, efficiently this way. And, you know, and this is a lot easier to deal with from a cache utilization and from a parallelization standpoint.
So out of curiosity, why the mesh refinement is not symmetric in flash?
Oh, there's probably just, you know, truncation errors, you know, like, I don't know, maybe, you know, there are always like little things that break exact symmetry unless you try to really enforce it somehow. Like, there could be things like, so, because when you refine blocks, right, you choose some quantity and you compare it to a threshold, right, and that's always subject to round off error, and then that propagates into a later solution. So I think that's what's happening here.
So I think one point to make here, and probably it's obvious, but
These are very good approaches, or they potentially have potential applicability when you have a well-defined location where there's a sharp gradient, there's a high structure that you want to solve. But for the kind of problem that we were just talking about, turbulence or anything that generates a stochastic structure, they basically have an ultraviolet catastrophe. They basically will always try to refine more. You have to make a decision to stop somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you always have to, even in these calculations.
Sure.
You can't afford arbitrary. I mean,
sure.
You know, an arbitrarily sharp jump, you'd have to refine that arbitrarily much.
But if the, what I'm saying is that the structure, the instabilities or whatever you're trying to model generate smaller scale structure, you have to stop.
Yeah,
that's
right. So there are problems where this buys you a lot and problems where it doesn't.
That's right.
Buy you a lot.
That's right. Yeah, so like if this generated some turbulence right here, right, that would probably all refine maximally and it would stay that way.
So you're right, that just can be rotated and you would probably...
Yeah, I've never seen it.
Patch by patch.
Patch by patch, in principle, but that's too much headache. So and most people don't do that. Like I said, I've never seen it. But in principle, the framework that they outlined allows for that. That you might get into conservation issues and things like that. Okay, so there are a lot of different ways that you can choose to mark refinement. You know, if you know where there's going to be some place where you want to be refining, you can do it geometrically, you can do it on the value of a quantity. Usually in compressible applications, we refine on something like the second derivative or a scaled second derivative of a quantity like the pressure or the density. And so here's a galaxy cluster moving through a wind, and you can see that I refined, this was back before we had particles in flash, so I had a fixed background dark matter potential, and so I refined the edge of the initial cluster, and then shocks, and then as you can see, this contact discontinuity got refined here, and this whole region, as the Kelvin-Humboldt rolls get bigger and bigger, that whole region refines uniformly.
What's that refinement that goes out front?
Out here?
Yeah.
Oh, that's from the initial conditions. Yeah, that was the geometrical. This is just something I use to illustrate refinement. But.
Is it just geometrical, or it's some shock, little shock which goes up front?
No, it's geometrical. It's geometrical. I put it in there. Okay. It's not a shocklet. but no, this is the shock. Yeah, there's no precursor here. Yeah, this was a problem with an inflow boundary. Right. So there's a bow shock.
So why doesn't the mesh refinement algorithm realize that that's a smoother area and doesn't need it anymore?
Because I told it to refine.
Told it to do it.
Always, yeah.
Okay.
Now, you can get cleverer and you can say turn it off after a time, and now we have particles so we don't even need to do this.
Okay.
This is just an illustration. Okay, but with refinement, of course, that means that your mesh is solving, it has its own equation. And that, of course, would be true with a quasi, adaptive Lagrangian Eulerian code as well. And so that means that convergence, again, can do funny things to you. So this is a standard test problem that we used in the flash paper, where you have a wind tunnel. There's a Mach 3, I think, wind tunnel with a step. And it generates a bow shock and a bunch of, and a boundary layer here and a bunch of reflections. There's reflecting on top and bottom. And so you get a lot of nice reflections. You get a Mach stem here. And there's a slip line that develops right behind that. And as you increase the number of levels of refinement, that slip line gets better and better resolved. And so you expect that as you increase the number of levels of refinement, that would just continue to happen more and more. But when we go from 4 to 5 with the default flash thresholds, suddenly the region behind here becomes less well refined, does not get better than this, and the instability doesn't grow there. It starts up later, but it doesn't grow here. And so if you look very closely at that, right here, it's getting better and better, and then bam, it's worse. And so what happened here was that because of the threshold that was used for the refinement, somehow this didn't get triggered. And as a result, the grid resolution was low enough that the truncation error, the numerical dissipation there, suppressed the growth of the instability. And then, it grew later on because it just, there was more refinement in those regions for different reasons. But that was something you could solve by just tweaking the refinement threshold a little bit and making it refine there, and then bam, you get what you expect.
So
Is there viscosity here?
No, this is, again, just PPM with no...
Euler equations.
Yeah, Euler.
The vorticity line generated by a triple point can never be converged because it will mean the wavelength of those vortices will always be as small as the...
Yeah, it's always being seeded, right? The instability is always being seeded by grid scale fluctuations, and those get smaller and smaller, but never go away. So, yeah. But, you know, again, it's an illustration that, you know, refinement can introduce unexpected complications, and that's especially true when you use particularly aggressive refinement. When you say, I want to refine as little of the volume as possible and get away with as little refinement as possible, that can result in problems like this. And a final thing I want to say about refinement is this test problem. This is the SOB problem is a classic 1D test problem. Every hydro code must pass before it gets accepted in the Astrophysical Journal. And this is kind of, I just tweaked this to raise the left pressure so that I got a stronger shock. And so this is what it looks like if you do flash with 9 levels of refinement. It looks very nice, sharp. Right, so this is refined, like this is resolved with like one zone, resolved. It's smeared out over just about one zone. So
the 1D.
Yeah, just 1D. I ran it last night on my laptop. Took about 2 seconds, and so it starts off at x equals 1, and this is at after 0.06 in time. Right? So this is without doing anything funny, just refining on density. And the next thing I do is to do something funny. Which is to force degradation of mesh refinement after x equals 2. So I don't allow those regions to refine above level 2 or 3. Level 3. And this is what you get. Right. So it's worse, actually, than it would be if I just were solving this problem with 3 levels of refinement everywhere. And the reason is that when the shock hit that forced refinement boundary, it actually encountered a region of greater viscosity, greater artificial, greater numerical dissipation. And so it was an impedance mismatch and a reflected wave. Right? So, and you can see some of that wave here contaminating this. And so you must never, never, never allow a shock to cross the refinement boundary unless it's already gotten so weak that it doesn't matter anymore. And for this reason, when you calculate that criterion that you compare with thresholds to decide where to refine, you do that in the boundary zones as well. And as long as the Mach number of the shock is not really large, that means that because of the CFL criterion, it will not move more than a couple of zones in any given time step, which means that if you calculate the refinement criterion in the boundary zones and the boundary stencil is large and the boundary region is large enough, then you'll always catch a shock wave that wants to come into your block before it does so and refine in advance of it. But if you have a very high Mach number shock, it may get there before you detect it and with consequences.
So is one of the lessons here that it's okay for a shock to move through a zone that's becoming more refined, but not one that's becoming less refined?
In principle, I guess you could get a reflection from either case, but probably it's worse if it goes into a lower refinement region. Now, that said, you do stuff like common envelope, generate shocks everywhere. They want to propagate out, and maybe at some point you don't care about them that much. You're not going to run the simulation long enough for the reflection to come back in and contaminate the solution, and they've already had an effect in the center, and then maybe they're just doing stuff to the fluff, basically, out there. In that case, you know, I think you can get away with, you know, forcing, like, no refinement out there or little refinement out there and just allowing those shocks to be slightly affected by that because they're already weak and they're already not affecting things that much. But that's the sort of thing that you have to check. Yeah.
So there are schemes, I don't know what you think of them, that are less, you know, sharp refinement boundaries, like particle gridless and deformed mesh schemes. So do you run into problems there, or do you just not see them because they don't come in as?
I think probably the latter.
Are you going to talk about things like
just block structure and adaptive.
It's all, you know, you're still in a nice, as long as you're nice and block, you know, you have squares, it's still nice, the discretization is nice. Once you start getting zones that look like this, there's lots of tricks that people do to try to make it so it actually makes sense. Uh-huh. So it gets much harder. So if you think this is bad,
absolutely. I mean, like I said, you know, you could probably teach a second semester on unstructured meshes and things. But what happens?
They have your screens too, so they're good for some.
You have to sign up. That's right. So what Chris is talking about is that, you know, when you have a mesh that's deformable, and maybe can also adapt as well as being deformed, generally you get maybe regions where there's a lot of compression in one direction but not in another, and so you get long thin zones. And in each direction, right, you have truncation error, but the truncation error is now a lot bigger in this direction than it is in this direction. So it's an anisotropic truncation error. Like, this is anisotropic too, but at least it has the grid symmetry, right? So, yeah, I don't want to touch that.
I mean, one of the tests would be just to take a problem and tilt it relative to the Cartesian. It must make a big difference, right?
It can.
You tend to want to choose your grid refinement to.
Again, you can pick test problems that make things look good, codes and algorithms look good. When you're doing verification and you're checking out a code, one of the things you do is you, like, sod problem, you do not just run it parallel to the x-axis, you run it at an angle, and not just 45 degrees either, but like square root of two, degrees or something like that. I don't know, just things that are not commensurate with the mesh. That's the guy's name, Gary Sod.
Yeah, sorry,
this is the sod problem. It's like a classic.
And then, you know, where your grid, you know, and I don't know if you have this demo, but where the grid can make a difference and why you might go to one of these other methods of doing it, even though you have to pay for it, is that if you tried to do this explosion now in a spherical setup in your Cartesian grid, you now have the problems of the fact that you're trying to do a spherical.
So what I didn't show here, this is the set-off problem, another classic problem. And what I didn't show here is that, so why is there all this structure going on here? This is density. If we're refining on density, why are we refining there? Well, it turns out that these are both Cartesian, right? There's a lot of noisy velocity structure down there where the velocity is getting very low. So you don't see that here, right? But, you know, you might wonder, why is there refining here at all? That's where it's coming from. You know, there's some noise in the density, I think, that's coming about because of the noise in the velocity field. And again, that's something that comes about because of the grid. Grid
density goes to zero analytically in that problem, so maybe small non-zero fluctuations lead to it. Everything from the initial conditions is left
behind. That's right, yeah. So when you compute a scaled second derivative, then it looks big. And you can suppress that kind of thing, you know, by saying, there's lots of things that you can do. Now you have this additional degree of freedom of messing with the mesh. You know, there are many things that you can do and many pitfalls to the things that you can do. And so when people present a scheme for handling things, you need to see that they tested that have some way of explaining away. It's, or at least people don't always bother even to do that. All right, so I want to talk a little bit about initial conditions. And so for this, I have two model stars. One is the one we used back for my papers with Ron Tam earlier. And this was generated with the Eggleton code. It's a 1.05 solar mass star, red giant, near the tip of the red giant branch. And the second one is the one I've been working with lately, which is this MESA model I generated with low metallicity, 82 solar masses by the time it reaches this point. And it's got this density inversion here. which, you know, I showed this plot in the conference, but and you know, one way that I've coped with that so far is to, you know, just flatten that, or flatten the entropy profile out there. It's not correct, you know, that assumes efficient convection, which I know is not right, but you know, it's a model to start with. And so one thing I need to talk with Stan a little bit more about is there a better way of doing that?
Sorry? Let me know.
So, I mean, but I don't want to do, like, variable eddings and tensoration hydrodynamics for this problem. I don't think I could afford it. But but is there some way that I can, in the 3D simulation, I mean, yeah, there's a 1D model, but there's also the 3D simulation. How can I, you know, sort of incorporate some of those effects? And that may be a big research project, but at least, you know, something to start with. What's a reasonable starting point? This may be it. I don't know. Anyway, so that's my 1D model. And of course, you know, it goes without saying that there's no way you're going to get to this point in 3D. So you've got to start with this 1D model somehow and then map it onto your 3D simulation where things start to get interesting. Mm-hmm. And so the way we've done this before is to linearly interpolate that 1D profile onto onto the flash mesh directly as a single star. And because it's a finite volume code, right, what you want is the zone average in each cell. That matters most near the center. And so near the center especially, you know, we take multiple sampling points in each zone and just take an average in those. So rather than trying to do some complicated, you know, integration over each zone, we just do that sort of Monte Carlo-like method. And then we relax that single star by itself. We damp the velocities. You know, this is what we used to do by just multiplying the velocities by a factor, and then, you know, that take that factor, make it 0.9 to start with, and then run it for a while, and then make it 0.92, and then run, you know, and get closer to one, and then finally to start the common envelope simulation, we put in a companion, which is a little particle cloud, and set things in rotation, co-rotation. Actually, we break co-rotation explicitly by multiplying the rotation speed by 0.95, And so, you know, that gives you something that does, you know, that is a calculation you can do. And we did. And you know, it didn't produce completely crazy results because other people have done different things and gotten similar results. So I don't, you know, I'm not disavowing my previous work.
Where are the velocities coming from that you're having to relax away and
that stuff? Oh, because when you interpolate a 1D model onto a 3D mesh, especially if it's adaptive mesh, then it's not in equilibrium anymore. Yeah.
There's also, you may have to interpolate your 1D model onto a finer 1D mesh and run it explicitly with hydrodynamics, and that you'll find there are waves.
Okay. Well, that's.
Sorry, I didn't quite understand where these losses. I thought you had a hydrostatic in the 1D model.
Yeah, it's hydrostatic in 1D.
So when you throw it out, when you first put it on there, it's
not quite hydrostatic.
So you had a spherical grid.
I do not have a spherical grid. Does this look spherical to you?
Yeah, because you have a little, yeah, well, you can even see the curtain. Yeah, you can see it there. But yeah.
I mean, it's not a spherical problem.
It is mappable. It is mappable if you could do a spherical grid, but then it's not a spherical problem, so you know, you're not happy there.
Not even a spherical cow.
So, yeah. If you didn't have the companion, the problem would be spherical symmetric in principle. I mean, the equations are for a spherical symmetric star. So if you do the procedure.
Okay. So you also have way worse resolution in 3D than in 1D, okay? So it's also taking the fact. I mean, just if you will take the messy star with, for example, 1,000 mesh points, and you will now convert it to 100 mesh points, you will find that your cells are not in exact equilibrium. I mean, you will try a little bit to figure them out.
Sure.
It's just straight that direction will not help.
Sure. It's also worth remarking that even mapping a 1D stellar model into a 1D hydro code isn't completely straightforward, because, you know, you've got very steep pressure gradients that balance very strong gravities, and if the two aren't exactly matched,
be relaxation.
So I'll hit that point later. But but yeah,
because you have a reference state.
Yeah.
This is why.
Yeah. So.
Polychromes.
Been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly.
So.
What are your
clouds? I mean, is that some?
These?
Yeah.
They're just, that's cream in my, no, that's, those are effects. Those are.
Someone's like, oh, can I figure that? Can I do something physical with that?
No. What are known in the parlance, or in the vernacular, as artifacts.
Paul, just still hear about the fluff.
We'll get there. Sorry, I'm getting maybe too gradually, but again, there are many, many issues to deal with here. This is why you train to become a numerist. Anyway, another issue, actually, both of you raised very good issues with even mapping 1D onto 1D. Another one is that, like, Mesa is a Lagrangian code, right? It uses, generally the mesh spacing varies smoothly, can vary smoothly. Anyway, here, the mesh spacing does not vary smoothly at all, right? It doubles or halves in any given location. And so that means that even if I did a 1D flash simulation where I had refinement into the center, I would have these jumps in refinement, which would not exactly mirror, the Mesa mesh. And so again, I would be doing interpolation. Now, there are ways to make sure that, you would have to be careful about conserving the total quantities. Ken Shen actually had a paper on this which came out of work that Alex Hager and I started on, where we were trying to look at pair instability supernovae in flash. We were going to try to map the initial conditions on the flash. Anyway. That eventually led to something that Ken wrote. So, but beyond that, right, once we've got, let's suppose we had a perfectly hydrostatic model and we put in the companion, it's clearly not an hydrostatic Google, and that's not how stars reach the Roche-Loeb overflow state, right? That's, companion doesn't simply appear, right? So what happens then is that the star is, not in dynamical equilibrium with the Roche geometry, and so it is in the process of relaxing into that at the same time that, the overflow happens. And so,
can you bring the companion in slowly?
Yeah.
Or make it growing mass slowly.
That's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought of that. But that's one way. And in fact, that kind of gets to what I'll talk about as the new improved method in a moment. Problem is that would take a long time, to do it right. It's a lot of time, so it's expensive, right? I want to keep the AMR for the interesting stuff.
But if you need to get rid of the initial transient. You're spending that.
Yeah, I would like to make the initial transient as small as possible. So how do I do that?
You start with the somewhat
yeah, yeah, you guys are suggesting solutions. I'm about to suggest another solution. This is what we've done in the past.
That's what
you did. Yeah, okay. So this is what we're doing now. Right? Maybe it's dumb, I don't know, but this is to use SPH. So I'll let Jamie talk about SPH tomorrow. I'm not going to go into the details of it, but the idea here is that we can, nothing interesting is happening here except relaxation. Right? There should be nothing interesting happening. No shocks in particular. Well, less gravity waves reach the surface and shock. Thank God. Anyway, so should be no shocks. So my normal, scruples about SPH sort of go by the wayside. And there's no doubt that it's...
That's the nicest thing I'll hear about SPH.
I'm using a heavily modified version of your code, StarCrash. Not Star Smash, which I guess is a later thing. Anyway, the one that you can download, but then it's like completely reworked to have different equation of state and do energy equation and stuff. And this, yes, you can scan in the companion, and since it's relatively cheap per time step, you can do many, many time steps where you just gradually scan it in. And so that's what we're doing right now. And so this is an example of my massive star doing that, and just about where it's about to hit Roche-Loeb overflow, and then I can map that using the SPH kernels directly into flash, and I use the SPH kernel sizes to sort of pre-refine the mesh to figure out where I should refine the mesh. Three things to note about this. One is these plumes that I mentioned in the talk. Right? These plumes, they look innocuous here, but you just run this for a little while longer, and I'll show you what happens. I don't know whether those are real. I mean, this would be convectively unstable, but I don't know whether you should get giant plumes like this. Secondly, SBH does great in high density regions, but if you need refinement or you need high resolution in places where there's a sharp gradient or something like that, where it isn't high density, then it doesn't help you. And so initially, the SPH pre-refinement doesn't hit the boundary here. And so that actually winds up slowing down the initialization because I have to refine that a few times on the SPH density field. So the third thing is that, so I can, again, break co-rotation explicitly by just altering the velocities of everything that comes out of the SPH. But that's only appropriate to one way of breaking co-rotation, and maybe not the one that's actually appropriate to massive stars.
So you could get away with doing, are you doing equally massed particles for the SPH?
Equal mass.
Yeah, you might be able to get, you know, if you wanted to refine that outside better with the SPH, just do, you know, unequal mass.
Yeah.
Really resolve it.
Yeah, we usually do it very on equal masses.
I mean, okay.
The factor of 10 to 5, I think, difference between.
Wow.
10 to the 5?
Yeah.
Wow.
Between the internal.
And you don't get, like, dynamical friction effects?
So the only thing where you would get killed is
not that.
If the really low mass particles see the big particles, that would kill you.
Right. Okay. Yeah, you're right.
But in this case,
maybe
right
have a gradual.
Yeah, it's gradual, and you won't see it.
Okay. Yeah, in cosmological simulations, too, sometimes people have big particles providing a tidal field. As long as none of them pass directly through your galaxy cluster, you're good. But if one does, then that's bad. Okay. So I can initialize this. Everything looks great.
Let me say by convective plume. Are we formed by how many particles?
I haven't counted them.
Just
but
one particle? Because
no,
one particle
no.
can appear as a plume.
No.
Okay.
And the velocities here, the velocities in these plumes are like 30 kilometers a second.
And is that associated with the iron bump?
Down here?
Oh, no. The iron bump's down there.
Well, I don't know. That's where they start.
Okay. Is that the temperature there?
It's super dry. It's not a radiation hydrodynamic simulation.
Right. It's also
hydrodynamic
simulation. Yeah, that's right. So that's also true. There's no opacity being put in explicitly.
Okay.
I'm thinking of the physics and the continuum equations. Think of the degraded models with not all the physics.
Physics equations.
That's the thing. It's like when you're analyzing the results of these things, you always have to sort of figure, you know, is this because what I'm doing is not real,
yeah,
or is it because of real physics? And to make things more spicy, you know, you can sometimes have real instabilities amplifying things that are not real.
Exactly.
So this is what happens in that SPH.
SPH get that good resolution.
That's a lot of particles.
Especially the flowers.
Very no
condition. Oh, yeah, okay, here's the
comes.
It
ripples that are going to hit the face. Yeah, small gravity waves, yes.
Wait.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the star by itself, not in a Roche geometry. And
it's still SPH, right?
Yeah, this is just the SPH. Yeah. So you see these plumes, and I'll show you what happens when I...
Are you sure you have a stable entropy profile?
It's not stable, but I'm not sure whether it should resolve into giant plumes or just into turbulence. Yeah. Okay. So I think what I'm going to do is instead of fooling around with this.
Your resolution is low, then you get giant plumes.
Oh. Okay. Maybe
you can
try duplicating some stuff. This is. I think this is the model that shows it best. This is in the binary potential and showing the XZ plane, so it's, you know, it's kind of, it should be flattened up here. See, everything looks okay for a while. But these plumes are growing and. And I actually ran it for a little while. You actually start seeing it doing Roche-Loeb overflow, which is kind of cool.
It's very optimal.
Looks like a star.
If you look on Betelgeuse, it's also not spherical, so you should look there.
Yeah. So if you just drop that naively into Flash, and this shows actually a bug or a problem that I'm not sure about, but you see what happens right away here is that.
It's common envelope. No, this is a supernova ejection, which we couldn't launch from normal supernova explosions, but.
Well, and this also maybe get into some of the fluff issues, yeah. So that's obviously.
So you solved the supernova problem.
You guys are so sarcastic.
No, we are very optimistic.
We just like, this is nice to see somebody else suffer.
No. You made me feel better about my suffering.
That's right. Schadenfreude is a
good purpose in life is to serve as an example to our warning of others. So now.
But you see, so just to say, the people who model galaxies, they just don't know about those problems because they don't sure that if a star should be round or not round. You can compare it to someone else. So you just probably they have the same troubles, right?
They're fluid simulations, but it's not true they have no constraints, right? They have spiral galaxies to look at, and you know, things that like have the wrong angle of momentum, for example, for their masses, and definitely.
So when you did that SPH, did you march the companion in, or did you place the?
That one was a scanning simulation. Yeah. And if you scan it too fast, of course, and the core, the core gets a little out of equilibrium with its giant envelope. So you have to do that slowly enough. So there are a lot of, it's not like you can drop in the masses of the companions or initial separations and then go with the default values. Like some codes, I would like to do stellar evolution with MESA and that the defaults will serve me well, but.
No.
Exactly. And so that's also the case here, right? Is that this relaxation procedure, and a bunch of other things, you can't just go with defaults necessarily. You have to look at this is why setting up the initial conditions has taken me so long. That and queue delays. If I had to wait 3 days for a calculation to run. Okay, so. So this is not entirely gas that I'm doing here. I'm actually including particles, and I would like to solve everything with gas, but because that's what it all is. But unfortunately, that would boost my spatial resolution requirements, because I'd need something like the orbital semi-major axis to the core radius, which could be very large. But even more restrictive is the time step stability criterion. So in the center, right, the CFL time step ought to be something like the dynamical time in the core, and the time I want to run the simulations is clearly something like an orbital period, and so that's going to go like the ratio of the central density that I resolve, the central density in the star to the average density to the 1/2. So that could be very large, for a red supergiant in particular. So I have to replace the high-density core with something that doesn't shrink or expand, doesn't behave hydrodynamically. Oh, the other thing is actually what Richard was alluding to, which is that truncation errors in the solver actually make it hard to maintain hydrostatic equilibrium when basically the code looks at a very steep pressure jump as a shock, a very stationary shock. I said something about truncation errors behaving like velocity and derivatives of velocity. So if you have a very stationary shock, those truncation errors, become zero in one place and not zero in another place. It makes it hard to actually maintain this stably and accurately. Okay. So best thing to do is to just try to avoid that. I mean, if that stuff isn't going to change much in the simulation, replace it with something that, just is locked and frozen, and just do gas dynamics for the rest of the calculation. Of course, there are problems with that, right? If you were to burrow in deeply enough, eventually, by removing stuff from the envelope, you would reduce the weight on the core and should expand a little bit. But hopefully the time scale for that is long compared to the ones you're interested in.
So I'm a little confused about what was going wrong in the simulations that you showed. So will you still get the star kind of exploding even if it wasn't the companion? You just
Because
it looked like the plumes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they've just been running.
Regardless of whether the companion
right.
comes in.
And so there was. It seemed like maybe the plumes start off because there should be some convection. Mm-hmm. But if you say about adiabatic, then as they rise, they'll reach an area that's stably stratified, and then they're going to want to fall back in. And we didn't see that at all. So.
It's asking a lot.
But, and then they'd launch waves, which would be pretty strong and would lead to shocks.
Yeah, but none of this stuff is going to be comparable to the escape energy that you need to push things.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, after a long time, it may settle back down.
So is there...
That's not necessarily true, because the outside of the star is very low density, and the inside is very low density.
We're talking about binding energy per unit mass, gm over r, relative to the characteristic speed square that you have. Like the sound speed squared is 1,000 times smaller than the escape speed squared for a typical star. So those plumes just can't be physical. My first judgment.
Yeah. No,
Is there any clear explanation for what's going on, or is it just that you like tried to run it and it gets something weird and?
Well, I don't see that in a low mass star. So I don't see those kinds of plumes in a low mass star. Which is good because I didn't see them before. But
a few years ago, when we tried to do massive stars also with this page, but with like particles which have changed, we also had problems with plums. We actually didn't look that carefully, just what we maybe spend a month or two trying to figure out what's going on. But yes, we also were not able to put the star in the relaxation. Okay. Maybe Jamie updated after that the code, but it was like 4 years ago when we looked at this. And
yeah, there's a couple issues. I've never seen plumes before. The first time I ever saw it like that. I have certainly seen the outer layers going out.
Yeah. So we saw the outer layers for massive stars.
So one thing I should say.
Let me just ask a question though first. In the equation of state, is there any changes in the equation of state as you go from your 1D model to your SPH?
No, same.
Exactly the same.
Exactly the same.
And just to counter what Stan just said, the sound speed in the core is of order the escape speed at the surface. And so if you can create flows, and what you saw was flows that had about the same speed as they were leaving the stars they had.
It's like looking at a Git branch, you know, history.
Maybe that's true, that you'd have to get some kind of transport, a pulsation that starts so deep inside.
Good, let's
that
talk
it
can't
give
that
you your energy.
Yeah, that's Friday.
Okay, Bill.
It doesn't look like a pulsation.
Bill.
I just want to make one short comment. All you physicists come up with these really wild, interesting physical explanations of what might be going on. I will be the computer science guy who always finds that, none of that's relevant. It's actually miracle issues. Can you actually maintain
it? Yeah, I think we all agree that.
Point being, before you go off looking for all these physical things, check for numerical problems first. Can you actually maintain HSE for long time periods? Your problems may actually be much, much simpler than the physical explanations you're
So this is a one solar mass model for five dynamical times.
Great. And is five dynamic times actually the time period you're going to try to simulate this other thing for?
The border.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm eventually going to do this at a resolution that will make it so that I can follow it for
hundreds of years. So thank you for resolving that question, because it's not trivial with...
Well, it doesn't resolve that question, right? Yeah. It shows that there's not a bug that affects the one solar mass star.
Yeah. That's
a
very
one
different
solar
mass
star.
Right. Yeah.
So the luminosity, the opacity, all these things are in your model?
There's no radiation.
Yeah, there's no radiation, right. Yeah. And there's no nuclear action. I have them turned off.
The opacity, all these things are in there. The dynamical response.
The solar mass model is much smaller than that.
Try to restore order.
Yeah. Radiation is in as a component of the equation of state. but as single temperature, but not as transport.
So when you say radiation, it's just in the equation, it's just...
Like I said, it's in the equation state, correct.
Are you doing it, so you have, it's not a general log gas, it's actually a ideal plus...
Yeah, and it's not ideal because it's got recombination energy, it's partial ionization equations.
But that, I'll bet that's where...
There are issues with that, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not solving the Saha equation, it's interpolating from tables, and blah, 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 blah. I mean, again, there are rabbit holes that we can go down, and everyone, I'm trying to steer like a little place around the rabbit holes, so that you, yeah.
I mean, that's the key point about the star gets to be very, very luminous, and it starts to look more like a gamma equal to fourth, or it's a polytrope, and then it's a lot different than a main sequence.
But maybe that's a very interesting question about the simulation, but not about the torque.
Yeah, I mean, and it could be related to the...
Well, it goes to the...
Yeah, Stephen, could you be the, like, the heavy for me? again, it's one of those things where, you know, physics and numerics interact. It could well be that there's something different about the you know, close to gamma four-thirds character of that star that, you know, interacts with some, like, resolution issue or numerical issue in SVH that... You know, one thing I wanted to say to Jamie was that this simulation has artificial viscosity turned off. Again, not expecting any shocks. But it's the energy formulation on it. Okay. All right. So there are different ways of handling the core. And what I've done in the past, what I've done for these simulations, is to choose a core mass and a corresponding radius from the enclosed mass profile, and then choose an artificial core radius that is resolved so that, you know, I avoid self-forces on the core because I map this particle's density. It's not one particle, it's actually a cloud of particles. I map them onto the grid using particle mesh. And if I were to use a single particle, that would result in a, you know, a not spherically symmetric force. So I have to make the core resolved. But that means then there's some gas left over between R sub C, the core radius, and the numerical core radius. And so I just redistribute that uniformly within the numerical core radius. And that works okay. This is the single star by itself for the low mass and the high mass case. You know, it obviously is changing the density profile here. And I've been looking, spending the last several weeks looking for ways to reduce this by finding a better way of treating that remaining core gas. In answer to Natasha's question way back, remember back at the beginning of the talk, like how many particles are in the plumes? It's a lot of particles, because that's the plume right there.
Oh, okay, maybe I have some plumes.
Interesting. Okay, but you see that otherwise, right, the rest of the star actually in the outskirts maps onto the model profile pretty well, okay, so. It's doing a, I mean, I don't think that there can no, well, it depends on your definition of catastrophic, but I don't know, I think this is doing pretty well. It has a ways to go, but, okay. So Ullman et al., they of the repo code, came up with a paper this year that looks into this core, setting up the core problem. They actually, they have a different kind of core. They have a single core particle that's got a spline profile. And so they cut that out of their initial density profile, and then they take the remaining gas and they solve the modified Lane Emden equation to redistribute that. And so I've been trying to get something like that working just in a standalone code so I can see what results. And so far, I don't know, it's been numerically unstable. I haven't gotten it working, but I've only worked on it for a couple of days, so we'll see. So I might try something like this. And they find, you know, they use different equations of state, and they actually have a way of solving this with an ideal equation of state where they solve the an equation for grad minus grad add, and they can force it to be convectively stable or unstable. And so that allows them to make very similar looking stars, one of which has a, you know, an unstable gradient, one which is stable. And so, for example, this is an AGB star that they had in their paper, and showing the Mach number distribution in a stable case and an unstable case. Now, in a red giant star, they actually get, you know, nice convection here That doesn't seem disruptive, but in the AGB star, they notice, you notice that they have really vigorous convection that distorts the star. I don't know if those qualify as plumes or not, but and this is a low mass star, right? This is like two solar masses. So, two solar masses. So, so there are other ways of handling the core that that may be better.
Do they have a? You can have heating even if you don't have radiation transport. You could have a heating that corresponds to the diffusion of radiation. Is that included? Because I know there are some.
In their work?
That have that.
In this paper? Not to my knowledge. No, I think they're just doing hydro with no radiation or anything. Yeah. Now, the resolution in this calculation, I think, is a lot better than the SPH. So it's possible that, again, this is some sort of, you know, turbulence and unresolved turbulence problem with my plumes. So maybe I just need more particles or something. In which case, that would make the SPH more expensive.
Do people think that this Model O is doing anything like a real star?
I don't know. It's hydrostatic. It's convectively stable.
Not P.
O.
Oh.
Oh. The one on the
oh, oh, sorry. O. Yeah. Oh. I don't know.
These like massive outflows.
You look at Betelgeuse, right? You see, bloop, you know. So, I mean. But whether that's the same thing, I don't know. I mean, every blorp is not the same as every other blorp.
So quotable
to So, okay, so moving on, the fluff, which Natasha asked about. So why can't we have zero density outside structures, right? A blob, a neutron star, whatever, is moving through a vacuum. Why can't we do that with a grid code? And it's like, obviously, an SPH code, you can do that very easily. It's great. Nice thing for SPH, very good for you. But for an Eulerian code, right, you need a density everywhere. And then when you need to calculate a sound speed everywhere, and so, you know, P over rho when density is zero is, you know, invalid operation. So that is the typical reason. But, you know, maybe we could treat those zones specially. I had this idea like at 2 a.m. last night. And I didn't think of this before. And so I went and looked Eulerian vacuum zones. And sure enough, you know, people looking at compressible water and cavitation, things like that, have schemes to have vacuum zones treated separately, differently from the non-vacuum zone. I haven't read this paper yet. It looks interesting. I'll think about it. But for the moment, I and everyone else I know who does Eulerian work relies on fluff. So what is fluff, you ask?
So, I mean, if you do that vacuum zone, what happens when you have some non-vacuum material flow into it? And I can tell you, we do this for, when we're doing Hohlraum calculations, we have vacuum Hohlraum, we put in material, and all we're worried about is the opacity. And there we say, this is this material, it has a, you know, a much lower opacity because I want it to be a vacuum, so I reduce its opacity. But if material flows into it, that material is still tagged and it gets counted. So you could do something like that, but you then sort of have to worry about when two materials flow in.
And clearly, you know, things get more complicated if you have to do different numerical methods in different regions.
And it's way easy if you do it 1D for sure.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's 2 a.m., right? So, yeah, you're right. I mean, when you set off a nuclear explosion underwater, it, you know, creates a, you know, zero, I mean, a set off explosion in a stiff equation of state. Forget what gamma has to be, but you get a zero density.
Is that what West Chinese guy's been doing?
No, well, they wouldn't be publishing that. No, this is about, I think this is about cavitation. And this is a while ago. So for some reason I hadn't thought of this as a possibility. Like you just do something different, you know. But
there's no hope. We get it.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so the fluff, right? So there are a number of considerations with the fluff, right? One is the total mass. You would like it not to dominate the mass in the box, right? And so that means you want a low density. And if your object has a filling factor F, then that means that the density of the fluff divided by the average density of the star has to be less than F over 1 minus F. And You also don't want it to be gravitationally unstable. That would be bad. So you it has to be hot enough, not be that. Yeah, you want it to be fluffy. You want it to be fluffy. And so the pressure, in addition to not being gravitationally unstable, you want it to be to roughly balance the pressure at the surface of the star. And the reason why is that if you have a low density, low pressure fluff, then again that surface is a shock wave then to the code, and shocks come out. So you would like that to not happen as much as possible. So you want P fluff to P star surface of the star to be about one. And if you assume a small filling factor, and then assume that the atmosphere, if it's a very sharp density gradient, the atmosphere of the star is like delta X across, then that means that the temperature has to be high. Okay, so these are two requirements that you want. Now the problem is the third requirement is directly counter to the second requirement. And that is that, remember that the time step depends on the characteristic speeds, which means including sound speed. So if I make this really hot, if I drop the density by a factor of say 10 to the fifth, and I match by an increase in the temperature of a factor of 10 to the fifth to compensate the pressure, then the sound speed goes up by 10 to the 2.5, and so the time step goes down by 10 to the 2.5, unless it's still higher than the time step required by the core. So you need something like the sound speed in the fluff less than the sound speed in the core. So it requires a considerable amount of filling and experimentation to find values of this, of the density and the temperature in the fluff that will A, not make your simulation really expensive, and B, not actually lead to numerical instabilities and cause problems. And that, again, could be causing some of the problems with the star exploding in the Eulerian case. It could also be just that those plumes are being seeded with velocities of 30 kilometers a second, so they just keep going, whether they're unstable or not.
So if you have some stuff going into fluff, so I understand that it will be shock going through fluff in the front, but there's always some wave also going backwards, right?
Yeah, but if... It's a different matter if I drive a Volkswagen into a tank of water and a tank of air, right? So, okay, I need a tank that's very thin, right? So that doesn't offer any resistance. Man, analogy. So the one case will destroy the car, and the other case will produce some air resistance on the car, but will not otherwise do anything. So. I guess it has to be supersonic too, doesn't it? So, I hate fluff. It's the bane of my existence. But this is in the sausage making category. You might think that you just straightforwardly, apply all of these numerical methods, and fluff or not, you just do the same thing. Well, the problem is that numerical methods are not always guaranteed to have nice properties, even if they're generally stable and not always strictly stable. In particular, our estimate of the CFL criterion is something that we calculate at the beginning of each time step to calculate the time step because it's cheap to do so. But in reality, with a Godunov scheme or whatever, the actual stability threshold may be some fraction of that, and that fraction may vary from place to place. And so you choose some safe factor like 0.8 times that, hoping that that covers the entire grid and that everything will be numerically stable. But there may be places in which you locally jump above whatever the real stability threshold is, given that time step. And those places will try to choke. And what I mean by choking, well, again, you get large oscillations and quantities that might need to be physically, or might need to be positive definite, and then bad things happen. Example, and then you feed those into an equation of state that may be very stiff, and then even more bad things happen. Most numerical codes these days don't try to build every piece of physics in the same update step, and so they use what's called operator splitting, and that operator splitting has its own truncation error, which may be worse than the truncation error of the individual methods. In any case, it's different. And there's this there's this property that's very desirable of hydrodynamic schemes called total variation diminishing, which is basically the observation that advection doesn't tend to create new wiggles. So it takes wiggles that already exist and it just moves them around. So the total variation in a wiggle shouldn't increase as a result in a time step as a result of a step. And so use this to, this is the origin of things like slope limiting and so on that you do to try to maintain this property in higher order schemes. People are bleeding away. Speed up. But when you have interactions with things like reaction networks and so on, then that's not always guaranteed. And then finally, the Riemann solvers that we use in Godunov schemes are not, necessarily exact. And I have this little tool that I use to try to diagnose problems in Riemann solvers, where I just put in the left and right states and then follow the iterations. And here's a case, for example, this is showing pressure versus velocity, and you start off with the left and the right states, and then just follow the Hugonio, adiabats, and the integral curves, and from iteration to iteration. And what happens is that, so this is the gray ones of the left state, you start here, and then you wind up down here, and then because that would, the next step would be less, you know, have a pressure less than zero, you apply a threshold, a cut, to make it just go back up to that threshold, and then it jumps over here for some reason and it behaves normally and goes to the right solution. But if I didn't do that, immediately upon deriving a negative pressure from my Newton iteration, the sound speed would blow up. So you need these little small thresholds, and the values that you choose for those thresholds can again affect the overall stability of your code and behavior of your code. So that's again in the sausage making category. All right, conservation. All right, so finite volume. Why do finite volume? These are all modern codes are generally finite volume, except when they're not, but generally they are. And there's a good reason for that. And that is that when you discretize conservation law in a finite volume way, so you take your averaging operator, just apply it to the equation, you get an exact equation for the update step. Right? This is an exact equation if I only knew averaged zone edge time averaged quantities for the fluxes. And then because I'm differencing these fluxes in a way that adds the same thing to every zone that it's subtracting from its neighbor, the total amount of stuff of Q or whatever Q is conserved, and there's no numerical approximation there. The only issue that might arise is round off error. The problem, of course, is that I don't know what these time average fluxes are in the future because they depend on the unknown solution at forward times. So all finite volume schemes involve approximations to this time average, cell boundary averaged flux. And so a Godunov scheme, for example, solves a little shock problem or Riemann problem at every boundary, and it figures out what, if that were a Riemann problem, what the time average value of the solution at that boundary would be, and it just uses those to construct the flux function right there. So that's how those work.
But as long as you take the same amount out of one zone,
I could replace these fluxes with random numbers,
the total amount could be wrong, but it'd still be globally conservative.
Yeah, exactly. So what that tells you is that this is a very weak constraint, right? So why bother caring about it? Well,
the alternative is much worse.
The alternative is worse. The alternative is worse. And so to illustrate that. Look at the nonlinear scalar advection equation. Remember, the linear scalar advection equation just had the sound speed right out in front. Here, it's the flux function, some function of q. And so the wave speed is actually df dq, right, which may vary with location. And so we can write this down, and this is the Riemann problem is always just a generic discontinuity problem. We can write that down and look for a self-similar solution. And we do that, we get this characteristic equation here, which has two classes of solution. One is where df dq is equal to x over t, and that's what's called a rarefaction fan. I'm going to not talk about that. I'm going to talk about the other class of solution, which is where w prime over t equals 0. W is this self-similar solution, self-similar function. And solving that means that the q has to be constant on both sides. So in other words, you preserve the discontinuity, but move that discontinuity around with some speed. That's a shock. Right? So you can get shocks in a scalar advection equation. It's not limited to the Euler equations. So the shock solution is just the propagating discontinuity, and there's the question is, what's the propagation speed? So you can do this procedure where you just integrate over across the shock in the shock rest frame to derive what in the Euler equations case would be called the Rankine-Hugoniot conditions. And here what that results in is left minus right states times the shock speed is equal to the difference in the flux functions evaluated left and right states. So you calculate the shock speed from this ratio. Right? So if these fluxes were wrong, even though you had explicit conservation, you'll get the wrong shock speed. And if you don't have explicit conservation, then QR minus QL won't be preserved properly. And again, you'll have the wrong shock speed. So the correct shock speed requires the correct jump conditions to be maintained, and thus also the conservation of Q. So, you know, the alternative is worse, right? So you like things to be totally conserved. The problem, of course, is we also like gravity, right? And gravity makes things go. And so we have these source terms in the Euler equations that look non-conservative. And thanks to Yang-Fei, there's actually a way. Well, you know, people knew about this way, where you have a tensor that you can use to express the momentum part of the gravitational field. And conservatively difference that, but Yang-Fei actually came up with a technique for doing that for the energy equation too, for self-gravitating systems. Basically, time differentiate the Poisson equation through some manipulations, and you get a non-unique but straightforward to compute flux here that you can then difference. And we don't actually do this. I guess I just haven't sat down to try to implement it, but it has some interesting properties. In particular, one of the tests in his paper looks at a spherical polytrope that's nearly unstable, but just a little bit on the stable side, and then you perturb it, right? So it should just go, you know. And so two versions of Athena, one with a non-conservative differencing and one with a conservative differencing, as you can see, produce very different results in that regard. In particular, with the non-conservative case, you get all kinds of grid artifacts. You get a sort of central empty place where I really don't understand what's causing that. But anyway, you get very different behavior from the conserved case. So there are cases where maybe you have the total energy close to a stability threshold where exact conservation matters a lot. And okay, so.
Sorry, so.
Yeah.
So can I take away from that?
That we should be doing that?
The importance of conservation is to the person doing the simulation, right? You should try and do conservation as well as you can. But if I'm reading a paper, the fact that the people doing the simulation achieved conservation is not really very strong evidence that I should trust the results. Okay.
It's a necessary but not sufficient. But like I said, it's a weak constraint. Yeah. So in high Mach number flows, which you know, it's something that people encountering cosmology all the time, but you know, conceivably in stellar cases as well. Normally, what you do, right? So normally, what you do to find the internal energy is solve, like, if you're doing things conservatively, you solve the internal as total energy equation, and you're solving a momentum equation. Now, that doesn't conserve this difference, obviously, because the internal energy does not satisfy a conservative conservation law. So you calculate the new internal energy by finding the difference here. But if both of these have truncation error, then and the internal energy is smaller than, you know, the kinetic energy by the truncation error, say, then you're going to screw up the internal energy completely. And if that makes the internal energy negative, then again,
you... Do you mean truncation or rounding? It is the truncation error?
It's truncation error, okay. Yeah, rounding is not enough here. Because they're separate, different truncation errors in each of these terms.
So that's actually not that difficult to run into that problem.
Yeah. 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 You don't need a Mach number of 10 to the 6. Yeah. So there are different ways of fixing this. One that, you know, again, comes out of cosmology, at least from my background that I first encountered it, is to give up on energy conservation in those regions and solve the internal energy equation, which, as you see, has a non-conservative term here. and then just replace the total energy with that. And so I think one issue with maybe trying to do Young Fei's technique is that in calculating the internal energy after a step, you still need to do a difference like this, which means that, again, in places that where now you're not just comparing epsilon to v squared, but you're also comparing it to phi, there might be places where you have to do something, and then it breaks energy conservation. So it may not be that, you know, that's the silver bullet, which, you know, when I realized that was very depressing.
This is only important in the cases where you have a self-gravity or if you have just a gravitational field, like near a surface.
Young Fei's technique only works for self-gravity, where the potential comes from.
Well, you can try to extend the, if the potential is fixed, it's, you can still do this, but that's not a big issue. The most important thing that error comes in, that the potential energy also evolves with time.
Well, what I mean is self-gravity is move the mass around and changes the form of the mass distribution. But what if you have a fixed mass and then you still have a very potential?
Again, that is not a big issue. The most important thing is the partial phi, partial t. If your phi is fixed, independent time, that is much easier.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. If you had an external time-varying tidal field, I guess.
Right. That is key.
Okay.
Okay, so that's something that you do. And so even in a code that somehow does everything, you know, says that everything is explicitly conserved, it may not actually be because it has to do something like this. All right, we're getting close to the end here, thank God. Anyway, so with momentum conservation, so you'd like to conserve momentum, and there are ways to do that, but that's not actually, in the context of numerical simulations, the same as Galilean invariance. So what Galilean invariance means in this context is if you were to just arbitrarily change the reference frame in which you're doing your simulation, will the results be the same? And the reason why it might be different is that, remember, there's velocity-dependent diffusivity in the Euler equations, numerical Euler equations. And so, you know, that clearly introduces, that breaks Galilean invariance. And this was leveled as a criticism in the Aripo paper, against Eulerian codes, and then Robertson et al. You know, showed that, well, you know, if you actually look carefully at the Kelvin-Humboldt instability, that kind of non-Galilean invariance behavior happens because you're not resolving the shear boundary. So if you do resolve the shear boundary, then you get convergence to the same limit, whether you're boosting the reference frame or not.
There's this comment. From
yeah. Yeah, well, so I have, you said Kelvin-Humboldt, so I have to mention this.
Okay.
That so I've looked at Kelvin-Humboldt's instability in Athena and also in a spectral code, and the spectral code, I'm using a formulation that's not conservative. Right? So I'm not conserving energy, not conserving momentum, and you get much better answers at the same resolution as Athena, which is conserving things. So but I think a key thing there is that Mach number was about 0.3. So maybe this doesn't work very well if you have shocks.
Yeah.
But for low Mach number, I'm actually not convinced that conservation is very important.
Okay. Well, one thing I was going to say about the Aripo paper was that, the claim there was that it maintains Galilean invariance because the grid can move with the flow. But has to do a regridding occasionally, which interpolates, and it also does a dual energy formulation. So,
So with the Ripo, did they do the, you know, this classic Galilean invariant test where you take a square and you watch it go, you know, across?
That's not the same thing as we're talking about here.
Okay.
That's linear momentum conservation. I'm just talking about doing simulations in different reference frames.
Yeah, so I would be moving it in through the reference frame. That's what a lot of people do to test. So they move it through that reference frame,
right.
And they watch. And usually, you know, I would be surprised if a repo does that well on that problem.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, it's a cleaner one because it's just looking at how do I go through a reference frame? Yeah. How do I go through my reference?
But would the repo grid move with the square?
It can, but it's regridding. Or, you know, it's doing, it has to do something to do that. So,
avoid stretching the mesh too much.
Or stretching the grid, so it's doing something. And the question is, how well does it do that? So we use a lot of AIL codes, which REPO is, you know, a high degree of.
and they do not do well.
Okay, I don't want to keep people from lunch, so I want to speed toward the end here. So, all right, conservation and practice. Okay, so that's the last thing I want to talk about. So, looking at the single star, not a square, but a star, more interesting. What happens in Flash if you just use SPH? You know, as we saw, the SPH model for the one solar mass star was pretty well behaved. So just drop it into Flash by itself, no companion, and see what you get. Let it move and let it spin a little bit. So,
that's
as you,
very good to me.
What?
Sorry, go ahead.
It looks or doesn't look?
It doesn't look very good. I don't know.
I don't know.
It's a one solar mass star. Late stage, when?
Near the red giant.
Okay.
Near the tip of the red. Yeah, no, it's not a compact
thing. I understand.
So, yeah, so all this stuff out here, yeah, it's very low density, but it's more dense than the fluff. And what you're seeing, so so this is conservation of the mass, and so what I've done here, I'm breaking it up into bound and unbound and comparing it to the total initial mass. And for energy, I'm comparing it to the sum of TU, or the kinetic, internal, and absolute value of the potential. And then for the momentum and angular momentum, I'm comparing it with the magnitude of the initial, so not the component values. Excuse me. So the mass conservation is not exact, even though you're differencing the conservation continuity equation. There's no source terms there. But there are open boundaries, and so some of the fluff can move out. Yeah, but there's a very small amount in this time. So so that's not a problem. With the energy conservation, it's at the few percent level. I'm not sure what these spikes are. I think they may have to do with behavior by the core, so I need to, again, one other thing to investigate. But again, I expect that to be at the few percent level, and I'm generally satisfied with that. What I'm not satisfied with and generally uncomfortable with is the momentum and the angular momentum conservation. They're at the level of 10% or so.
Oh.
And
are those just matched by boundary terms?
So
wait, this is a rotating? It's a rotating?
Yeah, it's spinning.
Star?
It's not spinning very fast, but it is spinning.
And it, okay. 10%? Okay. That's hard. I'm not.
Yeah, no, this is a brutal test problem.
Yeah.
So, and I meant this to be sort of illustrative of the worst possibilities. You see that the star is actually. Is jostling a little bit as it moves along, and it's probably, you know, although it relaxes, it's relaxed in SPH and then it relaxes onto the grid pretty quickly. As it moves along, you know, there's still deviations from strict hydrostatic equilibrium that that cause it to pulsate, or not pulsate, but wiggle a little bit.
So the spot is just the origin of the grid.
This is the origin, and this is the core.
So going back to Chris's insistence that we try to calculate error bars, mm-hmm. If we take a common envelope simulation and claim to derive an effective alpha from a hydro simulation, you're telling me the error bar on that should be 10% more? I mean, your energy conservation is a few percent for a really simple problem. What error bar would you believe on any derived effective alpha?
Well, this is why we just sort of hand-waved about alpha in our paper. Didn't try to say anything definite about it. You know, there I think we said like 25 to 50% or something like that, but it's like...
I mean, 50% in the total, right?
Yeah. Value 0.25 to 0.5.
So basically I could say alpha is 0.5 plus or minus 50, and that's the certainty we can claim. The full range.
I think so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But your energy, or, I mean, I agree with you. My problem is with your momentum and angular momentum error. That's maybe more damning than your energy.
So
energy looks good to me. I mean, if we're just energy for alpha, if they will, you get better than.
So.
To 5% for energy when you don't do any shocks and it's just a 3 or 4 dynamical time scale, it's not good.
This is really our problem.
And you notice that it's saturated, but it seems to have, it's not really growing. Let me stop the video and just go to the freeze frame for the last. Yeah, so that's the final slide, our final frame. And you see it's sort of, you know, it's not really growing very fast here. And even the momentum on conservation is roughly stabilized here. So
it's maybe brutal, but it's much simpler than the common envelope.
Sorry.
So you maybe for the momentum, it's actually just the problem with your initial interaction with the flood, because you have lots of specific angular momentum in the outer layers, and they are affected by flood as crazy. Right?
Yeah, so I thought about that. And so I just put a threshold cutoff on the density and just said, okay, just consider like 10 to the six, minus 6 or higher. And here I didn't have the outputs from the data file, so I had to compute them from the checkpoints, so there are fewer samples. You see that does improve mass and energy a little bit, but it doesn't really change the momentum or angular momentum that much. So I don't think this is dominated by the fluff.
Too bad.
Yeah, that was what
Does
I thought.
Does it have to be fluff because it's a conservative scheme and the only exit is the boundary and therefore...
But it's not it's exactly not conservative, right? It's got self-gravity.
That source term in there.
And it's got the particle, you know, moving in.
So SPH will have it's not as bad usually, but it has a problem with, again, with the gravity. You know, whatever you're doing for your gravity routine, you're not conservative. And so you can, your momentum need not be conserved. Mm-hmm. Even though the interactions between particles are
I'm hopeful that I can improve on this a lot, maybe by doing the differencing, you know, like the flux differencing somewhat differently. But yeah, I suspect that the energy is probably going to be about this level. All right. Okay. So what is this? This is. Oh yeah. So this was what's a dual energy formulation. And then without the dual energy formulation, I thought that might make a difference, and it doesn't seem to have made much difference. So it's not because I'm, you know, there are no high, really high Mach numbers in here. So. Okay, finally, God. All right, so so what or whom should you trust? And I want to say no one. But, trust but verify in finite volume codes. You know, this is where all my main intuition is formed in mass conservation, energy conservation to the few percent level, shock speeds and speed, shock positions and speeds, entropy production. I think those are probably pretty good. Mesh refinement, as long as it's not overly aggressive, but in every paper that does something like this, you should demand convergence tests. You should demand to see evidence that the code works. Yeah.
How does your energy conservation change with resolution?
That's something I haven't looked at here. But, yeah.
You mean right now?
I'm sorry, do I mean right
now? You didn't mean demand resolution.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's so demanding. So, yeah, what you should worry about is how the initial conditions are done, and in particular, you know, is there a good mapping from the long timescale 1D stellar model to a reasonable 3D initial condition? Is that a sort of physically well-defined transition? You know, maybe there's interaction with the fluff. I didn't talk about boundary conditions, but generally, you know, boundary conditions, you want them to be far away. Singular, that again gets into what I mean by that is if you do things in curvilinear geometries, then boundaries, reflecting boundaries, can cause artifacts that come from the geometry. Worry about momentum conservation. Worry about aggressive mesh refinement. And I don't think I've seen the kind of aggressive mesh refinement in stellar simulations that I have in cosmological simulations, but that's something you should worry about. And then also cores that are too small relative to the zones.
You mean stars that have already formed, because if you
yeah, sure, okay. And then cores that are too small relative to zones, because you may have strong gravitational fields that are not isotropic because of the grid's interaction, and so that may cause worse problems with momentum. So, all right, thanks. Sorry, I went way.